confessing my former ill feeling, meaning that I no longer have that. That I have come to the point in steps 4 and 5 and with 6 and 7, when I pray to have those defects removed, that I understand now and that I can give forgiveness. That's how I am going to find the other side. That makes sense? So then he's going to give specific directions on how to do this. Under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. So when can we argue or criticize? Is there any question about that? My guys ask me that all the time. But what if he said, under no condition do we argue? Simply, and this is all we do to make an amends, simply we tell him that we will never get over drinking until we have done our utmost to straighten out the past. We are there to sweep off our side of the street, realizing that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do. Never trying to tell him what he should do. His faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. If our manner is calm, frank, and open, we will be grateful with the result. So it's pretty clear how I'm going to approach, and this is specifically talking about how I would approach someone I dislike, but it's also the same approach to everybody else. This is all I'm trying to do. All I want to do is I'm coming to you, and I did, he said, you know, the word, I almost couldn't say the word right then. I want you to understand that I'm a member of a program that requires me to make restitution. And I need to tell you that I was wrong. I'm not sorry. I mean, I am sorry. But what I really was wrong. See, I don't want to be wrong. That's been my problem all along. I was never wrong. See? I'm wrong. And I have harmed you in the past. This is how I believe I harmed you. And by the grace of God, I'm going to change, amend, I'm going to change, and it will not happen again. And what can I do to make it right for you? How can I make restitution? We're not talking about reconciliation here. See, that was in my mind. Wow. Let's see, I'm going to go to my wife and I'm going to tell her all of this stuff, and then when I'm done, because I'm so honest and forthright, the spirit of love and understanding is going to come over her, and she's going to like say, oh, isn't it wonderful, Mike's sober after 36 years. I think everything will be just peachy from here on. No. My old best friend. I'm not looking. There is nothing for me except to clean up my wreckage. I am making restitution. I am talking of the change that's taking place to me in me because of my spiritual awakening. Page 78. In 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens. Sometimes the man we are calling upon admits his own fault, so feuds of years standing melt away in an hour. Rarely do we fail to make satisfactory progress. Our former enemy sometimes prays what we are doing and wishes well. Occasionally they will offer assistance. It should not matter, however, if someone does throw us out of his office. We have made our demonstration, done our part, it's water over the dam. Okay. I'm going to go, do what I have to do, I'm going to leave. Tell my guys, you go, you do what you have to do. That's it. And you shut up. You close your mouth and you listen. Is there something, you know, and I want to make sure all the harms are finished. Is there some other harm you want to tell me about? Shut up. It's not about them. So then to make sure that we understand what all of those things are, he goes to example number 2. Most alcoholics owe money. We do not dodge our creditors. Tell them what we're trying to do. We make no bones about our drinking. They usually know it anyway, whether we think so or not. Nor are we afraid of disclosing our alcoholism on the theory it may cause financial harm. Approached in this way, the most ruthless creditor will sometimes surprise us, arranging the best deal we can to let these people know we are sorry. Our drinking made us slow to pay. Then comes the warning. We must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go. For we are liable to drink if we are afraid to face them. I have to straighten out the wreckage of my past. If I have a financial, a material harm, I got to make it right. Now, I can't make it right today, but I could go make the amends and say, you know what? I stole $1,000 from you. And I know that. And I want to change. And I want to pay it back. Now, I'll send you 5 cents every 2 weeks. Whatever I can do. But I've got to be taking an action to clean up that record. What about my back Charlton for payment? What about what I did to somebody else? Oh, I can't go find that guy, you know. That guy that was a burglar, you know. How do I find the 300 people I burgled in Vallejo? No, you don't, but then maybe there's another, you know, we will find. God will show you, pray for that. And it'll happen. But I need to make the financial restitutions. Number 3, it says, perhaps we've committed a criminal offense, which might land us in jail if it were known to the authorities. We may be short on our accounts and unable to make good. We've already admitted this in confidence to another person, but we are sure we would be imprisoned or lose our job if it were known. Maybe it's only a petty offense, such as padding the expense account. Most of us have done that sort of thing. Maybe we're divorced and have remarried, but haven't kept up the alimony to number 1. She's indignant about it and has a warrant out for our arrest. That's a common form of trouble, too. Although these reparations take innumerable forms, there are some general principles which we find guiding. Reminding ourselves that we have decided to go to any length, another warning, to find a spiritual experience, we ask that we be given strength and direction to do the right thing no matter what the personal consequences may be. No matter what the personal consequences may be. We may lose our position, our reputation, or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink at anything. This is a test of that covenant. You know, do I have faith in the program and faith that I'm going to move forward? I have a number of sponsees that are facing, Bill uses the example of padding an expense account and not paying his alimony. But you can face some much dire consequences of that at the public court. And sponsees will say, well, what do I need to do? I don't want to go to prison for 10 years. I don't want to go to prison. I don't want to, I'm your sponsor. You got to get right with yourself and with God. And it says that I'm going to ask that we be given the strength and direction to do the right thing. So I got to go pray on that. I got to ask my God what it's going to take for me to set this right. It may mean that I'm going to prison. But it may mean that there's some other restitution that I can make. But I have to do that no matter what the personal consequences may be. So it says, usually, however, the people are involved. Therefore, we are not to be hasty and foolish martyrs who would necessarily sacrifice others to save himself from the alcoholic pit. It's a warning once again that Bill had back in the fist there. A man we know had remarried because of a resentment and drinking. He had not paid alimony to his first wife. She was furious. She went to court and got an order for his arrest. He had commenced our way of life as secured a position, was getting his head above water. It would have been impressive heroics if he had walked up to the judge and said, here I am. We thought he ought to be willing to do that if necessary. But if he were in jail, he could provide nothing for either family. We suggested he write his first wife, admitting his faults, and ask forgiveness. He did, and also sent a small amount of money. He told her what he would try to do in the future. He said he was perfectly willing to go to jail if she insisted. Of course, she did not. The whole situation has long since been adjusted. So we always look for the solution, and we got to pray on the solution, and we got to ask for the guidance and the strength to go forward. We We also get those situations on how do we clear others, and that's the next example on page 80. Is before taking drastic action which might implicate other people, we secure their consent. So it's not too cool to use other people's names to clean up your side of the street. If we have obtained permission, we have consulted with others, asked God to help, and the drastic step is indicated, we must not shrink. So I got to do all of those things. Once again, I can't implicate somebody else. And he gives us an example. This brings to mind the story about one of our friends. While drinking, he accepted a sum of money from a bitterly hated business rival. Giving him no receipt for it, he subsequently denied having received the money and used the incident as a basis for discrediting the man. He thus used his own wrongdoing as a means of destroying the reputation of another. In fact, his rival was ruined. He felt he had done a wrong he could not possibly make right. If he opened that old affair, he was afraid it would destroy the reputation of his partner, disgrace his family, and take away his means of livelihood. What right had he to involve those dependent upon him? How could he possibly make a public statement exonerating his rival? So what's the solution? After consulting with his wife and partner, he came to the conclusion that it was better to take those risks than to stand before his Creator guilty of such ruinous slander. See, if I need to always be looking for the way that I can right my wrongs, whatever that takes, and maybe that is going to somebody that wasn't directly wrong, like my wife, but is indirectly wrong, and I got to make it right there, and I got to keep making it right down that whole chain until I've cleaned up that wreckage of the past. Because the warning is, he said that he had to place the outcome in God's hands, or he would soon start drinking again, and all would be lost anyhow. See, can I go back to my God after I've asked that all my defects of character be removed, and I'm now made the commitment to do restitution, and then go back on my seven-step prayer and said, oh, by the way, that one thing I did to Bob, I'm taking that off the plate. I'm not going to do anything about that. You know, that's what we do. So he attended church. So in this case, he attended church for the first time in many years. After the sermon, he quietly got up and made an explanation. His action met widespread approval, and today he is one of the most trusted citizens of the town. This all happened years ago. So the chances are, number five then, the chances are that we have domestic troubles. Anybody in here have domestic troubles? Perhaps we were mixed up with women or men in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised. We doubt if, in this respect, alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people. But drinking does complicate sex relations at home. After a few years with an alcoholic, a wife gets worn out, resentful, and uncommunicative. How could she be anything else? The husband begins to feel lonely, sorry for himself. He commences to look around in the nightclubs or their equivalent for something besides liquor. Perhaps he has a secret and exciting affair with a girl who understands. In fairness, we must say that she may understand, but what are we going to do about a thing like this, like that? A man so involved often feels very remorseful at times, especially if he's married to a loyal and courageous girl who has literally gone through hell for him. Whatever the situation, we usually have to do something about it. If we are sure our wife does not know, should we tell her? Question. Not always, we think. If she knows in a general way that we have been wild, should we tell her in detail? Second question. Undoubtedly, we should admit our fault. She may insist on knowing all the particulars. She'll want to know who the woman is and where she is. We feel we ought to say to her that we have no right to involve another person. We are sorry for what we have done, and, God willing, it will not be repeated. More than that, we cannot do. We have no right to go further. So I can't implicate anyone else in what I've done wrong. And in some cases, there may be a wrong that it would be such a harm to the other person if they're unaware of it, that I'm not going to share that. That's why I do an 8-step list. That's why I share that list with my sponsor. That's why we look at how the amends is going to be made, and we discuss it before I go out making amends. I always have, every once in a while, a sponsee that decides that there's somebody out there that he has to talk to and make an amends to before he talks to me. He did step 3 and decided that he needs to go tell his wife about something. And inevitably, it creates more harm than it does good. So it says, though there may be justifiable exceptions, and though we wish to lay down no rule of any sort, we have often found this the best course to take. Our design for living is not a one-way street. It is as good for the wife as for the husband. If we can forget, so can she. It is better, however, that one does not needlessly name a person about whom she can vent jealousy. Right. I'm not out there trying to do more harm than I did when I was drunk. I've already done that harm. I only need to recognize that harm, recognize that I am wrong, indicate that I am going to change. By the grace of God and the program Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a new life, and I will make restitution as best I can. Perhaps there are some cases where the utmost frankness is demanded. No outsider can appraise such an intimate situation. It may be that both will decide that the way to go, the way of good sense and loving kindness, is to let bygones be bygones. So what do? Each night pray about it, having the other's happiness utmost in mind. Keep it always in sight that we are dealing with the most terrible human emotion, jealousy. Good generalship may decide that the problem be attacked on the flank rather than risk a face-to-face combat. I can't even say it. Then we come to the example number 6 that he uses, or the situation number 6. If we have no such complication, there's plenty we should do at home. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say that the only thing he needs to do is to keep sober. Wow, I'm sober now. Shouldn't you be happy? That's all I need to do. I'm finished. That's the usual answer I get. See, I want to have the same old behavior, just don't drink. See? I'm not amending anything other than the fact that I didn't put alcohol in my system. But I'm still selfish, self-centered, inconsiderate, whatever I am. See, I think the only thing I need to do is keep sober. Certainly he must keep sober, for there will be no home if he doesn't, but he is yet a long way from making good to his wife or parents, whom for years he has so shockingly treated. Passing all understanding is the patience of mothers and wives have had with alcoholics. Had this not been so, many of us would have no homes today, would perhaps be dead. I love this example. The alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken, sweet relationships are dead, affections have been uprooted, selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. He is like the farmer who came out of the cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife, he remarked, "Don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing?" It's a very important warning, top of page 83. Yes, there's a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fill the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindness, and love. The hardest amends to make. This spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. If I'm not doing step 12, if I'm not doing the part of 12 that says I'm practicing these principles in all my affairs, then I'm not living the amends. I'm not making the amends that I said I was going to make. I'm not changing my life that I change in 10, 11, and 12. If I don't grow in spirit, in understanding and effectiveness, then there is no restitution. So it says, unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought not urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than words. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone. See, I want to go home and I want to say to my wife, I got a new way of living. I've done these steps and I found a relationship with my God, and you need to come do it too. Right. No, you're the sick one. There's nothing wrong with me, and I'm not going down your path. That's fine. You know. And because of 36 years of drinking, then the book tells me that I got to have patience, tolerance, kindness, and love. Your Al-Anon program's not working. Too bad. You're out of here, baby. You know. I didn't expect my children to come running through the door and go, Dad, you're back. You got sober. 36 years later. So our behavior will convince them more than our words. What I asked God to do for me in the third step prayer, which was take away my difficulties so that victory over them would bear witness to those I would help. Those I would help don't only include alcoholics I would help, they include all those people that I've harmed that I would like to help as well. So then it goes on and it goes back to kind of the 8-step category types. And people talk about types of men. And it says there are some wrongs we can never fully right. Partial amends. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. So there's no personal contact. And there may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases. So there's some that I may need to defer. But it's just not right. But we don't delay if it can be avoided. And so that's the one that's now. I don't delay if it can be avoided. So this, once again, if I put down, if I do my, do an 8-step list and I'm put down, am I going to do it now? Am I going to do it partial? Am I going to defer it? Or am I never going to do it? You know? Then I can decide how I want to do that list. Then I can take that to my sponsor and I can discuss with my sponsor whether it's now, you know, whether it makes sense on any of those, and whether in fact I meet the criteria that the book talks about for making those amends. But we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considered, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone. So, what is going to keep me? I'm going to go to the 12 by 12 for a minute here. Actually visiting and writing people, top of the page, concerned now overwhelmed us, especially when we remembered how poor favor they stood among most of them, that we stood with among most of them. There are cases, too, where we had damaged others who were still happily unaware of being hurt. Why, we cried, shouldn't bygones be bygones? Why do we think of these people at all? So these are some of the ways in which fear conspired with pride to hinder our making a list of all people we had harmed. So I got forgiveness, that's an obstacle. I got my fear of facing certain people combined with my pride of not wanting to admit that I'm wrong as an obstacle. And in the last paragraph on page 79, he says, the third, which is self-delusion. This attitude, of course, is the end result of purposeful forgetting. I love that expression, purposeful forgetting. It's an attitude which can only be changed by deep and honest search of our motives and actions. So if I want to continue to tell myself that something didn't happen, I can do that as well. So page 80, first full paragraph, it tells us why this is so important. While the purpose of making restitution to others is paramount, it means the most important thing we can do, it is equally necessary that we extricate from an examination of our personal relations every bit of information about ourselves and our fundamental difficulties that we can. Okay, so the whole time that I'm doing my amends, Bill's also telling me that I'm going to continue with my inventory. I'm going to take away from this experience as much truth as I can about myself and about what my difficulties are, because I want to understand my obstacles and I want those removed. Since defective relations with other human beings have nearly always been the immediate cause of our woes, including our alcoholism. So that brings us then to the ninth step promises, which are read bottom of page 83. Starts off with a conditional word, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development. You know, they read these promises all the time in meetings, and somehow people, I got written here and said, you know, you hear it in meetings all the time, and it's sort of like it's the promises in the book, and there's promises at every step in the book, there's promises all over the book, but these become the promises in the fellowship. And I heard the expression once is, it's amazing what AA has become, because now people come to work the promises and hope the steps come true. It's amazing how many people come in and they say, yeah, I'm working on getting those promises. And I just hope that the steps come true. So it says if we're painstaking. So what does painstaking mean? Does that mean that if I'm painstaking about this phase of my development? You know, nowhere in this book does it say it's fun to do these steps. And there's probably no step that's less fun to do, at least in my mind and in my experience, than step 9. It was okay, you know, when I just had to like sit down and start writing out everything about my life, and I had a look at my life, and I didn't have to share it with anybody. And then I had to share it with my sponsor and share it with God. And that was kind of okay because I could always get rid of my sponsor. And, you know, God wasn't going to tell anybody else. But then I came to 8 and 9, and now the real pain sets in. Because now I got to go out to all those people that I've harmed. And if I did an honest and thorough, painstaking inventory, you know, I pretty much figured out that everybody that ever known me in my life somehow got harmed. That's a lot of harm. You know, it wasn't like, oh, the poor missus. It was like the poor missus and the poor missus's family and their cousins and the nephew. I mean, any fool that just happened to wander into my sphere of influence was damaged. You know, people I worked with, people that worked for me, people that were clients, people, it didn't matter. And so now the real pain sets in. Because I'm out there saying those things, the humbling thing that just kills me. You know what? I was wrong. That word just doesn't even want to come out of my mouth. And I want to make it right. What can I do to make it right? Because I have found a new way of living and I have changed. Whoa, the fear behind that. Now I've changed. I'm wrong. I'm changing. And I want to make restitution. So it means if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we'll be amazed before we are what? Halfway through. So there should be an expectation that I'm starting to get these promises, I wouldn't think, until I had like done steps 1 through 9 and 8 and a half. You know, so we're going to know a new freedom, a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of usefulness, uselessness, and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. You know, are these extravagant promises? We think not. They're being fulfilled among us sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if, conditional word, we work for them. And I always liked, and it's an interesting read, if you go back through, and Joe and Charlie, if you hear, listen to Joe and Charlie, is they substitute the word alcohol, and you understand that, you know, alcohol was my promise giver. So that if I go back in these promises, you know, it says, after I drink alcohol, I'm going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. You know, when I drink alcohol, I do not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. You see, I just didn't want to confront any of that part of life. Anything to change my reality now, I would change my reality now. So that's an interesting exercise. So I'm at the end of step 9, and what I've gotten to here in my mind is that I now have that kit of spiritual tools that Bill talked about on page 25 when he told me that we're going to go forward. 4 through 9 is my kit of tools. I now know how I can deal with everything that I have in my life. If I inventory it, if I share it with my sponsor, if I take it to my higher power, and that I make restitution for what I have to do. So, 8 and 9.
I'm pretty relaxed. All right. Very good, Mike. Thank you. Let us try finding step 10 in the book. After 9, right? If I can find it. Yeah. Here we go. Page 84. And he starts out, and we're down under the promises. And he says, are these extravagant promises? Well, if you're looking for the thought, that's the thought of these extravagant promises. We think not. They're being fulfilled among us sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. Slowly is an awakening. Bill had an experience which is different. It comes on you immediately. In the case of the rest of us, we have awakenings which come over a period of time. And that's the way mine comes. So he says, this thought. What thought? Are these extravagant promises? That's your thought. Bring us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. First 60 pages of our book lays out our first two steps, and they culminate in page 60, and it says we're at step 3. And it's the ABCs, being convinced of the ABCs, we're at step 3. I make a third step decision to get in fit spiritual condition. Page 77 says our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about it. How do I do that? 4 through 9. So when I take a third step decision, it's really about going 4 through 9 to get into fit spiritual condition. 10 and 11 will keep me in fit spiritual condition, and 12 is the work. Does that make sense? And this is a whole package. You can't have a piece. It'll be all the way in, or don't even come in at all. So Bill calls this the fourth dimension of life. Steps 10, 11, and 12. And this is where most people live today. Once they have gotten their inventory works out of the way, done 4 through 9, keep it clean and thin. Every once in a while, things do pop up from the past. Things that were suppressed in some way. Maybe you intentionally did. I couldn't get my mother's name down on a piece of paper for about 3.5 years. And I did some pretty decent inventory work. Year 1 and 2, I did a quick one. I was about 35 days sober, which had all to do with harms to my children and my first wife, which was pretty obvious to me. You didn't have to tell me I'd harmed them. So we vigorously commenced this way of living, vigorously. This way of living. What does Wilson say AA is? Page 15 of the 12 of 12. AA is a set of principles spiritual in their nature. When it's practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and make us happy, useful, and whole. And you need to measure your traditions against what AA is, not what you think it is. So, it's down one paragraph there. He describes the fellowship on top and then the second paragraph down. So that's what AA is, a set of principles. And behind each step, there are principles, and we'll get around to telling you if we remember. So, it says, vigorously commence this way of living as we clean up the past. So, a lot of people say, oh, I can't do 10 and 11 or 12 because I haven't finished my 9-step mess. That's not what this says. You usually make the first 9-step amends and you move into the fourth dimension of life as a result of that. There are amends you'll never get to make. If you wait until you've got them all made, you'll be 150 years old if you live that long. And you'll never hurt to help another soul. It says, we have entered the world of the Spirit. Where do we enter the world of the Spirit? In step 10. As a result of what? 4 through 9. Pretty easy, huh? Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. You start listening to fifth steps, my friend, and start sponsoring, you'll grow in effectiveness and understanding, I can tell you. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. Continue to watch for selfish dishonesty. We call that what? 4? For sure. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We call them 6 and 7. We discuss with someone immediately. We call it 5. And make amends quickly. If we've harmed anybody, we call it 8 and 9. It will keep me in fit spiritual condition on a daily basis. I shouldn't have to, if I've done this thing right, unless there's things I just couldn't come up with, it will come up. But I should be, after you've been sober a while and worked this process, you should be pretty neat. And if you're pretty neat, you'll be spiritually fit. And if you're spiritually fit, God can work through you. If you're not spiritually fit, He can't work through you. It's just that simple. I can't afford resentment, fears, and harms. I really can't. I refuse to live that way anymore. He said, and make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. Then, after we've done that, when I'm back in the fit spiritual condition, then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone who we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. Fantastic. Love and tolerance. Doesn't mean you trust them, but you love them and tolerate them. These are your 10-step promises. I love these promises. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. I got off the debating society of life a long time ago.
Well, by this time, Sandy will return.
When does it return? F10. As a result of 4 through 9. Not back in 3, not back in 2.
We seldom would be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as a hot flame. For us, that's the natural reaction. If something is poison, and it's marked poison, and you're going to pick it up, and so it's, don't drink that, it's poison, you recoil. Oh, my goodness. So, I was at a meeting one time, and a young lady came in. She wasn't a young lady, I mean, 40 maybe. That's pretty young. Anyway, she's middle-aged, young, something. I'll get over there. I got my foot out that I can't get it back. So, she came in and she proudly announced that this was her home group. It's a pretty good group of meetings. There's 5 meetings a week there at noon. And a lot of old-timers come to it. A lot of people that don't go out at night much. So you have a tendency to get people that are sober many, many years. And she said, I just have to tell you, though, she's very proud of her year. Well, she should have been. Her and God's year. And so she started to cry. And she says, I have to tell you the truth. I wanted to drink yesterday. And so she said, I called the women, but they were all at work. Nobody was home. I tried to call men. I know I'm not supposed to do that, but it did anyway. I lingered around. Talked to my 5-year-old kid. That didn't help much. And finally, I prayed. And I got past it. So after the meeting, I went to, I just couldn't stand to see her in that kind of pain. And I took out the book, and I looked on step 10, and I said, let's see what happened. It said, we'll seldom be interested in liquor. You were interested. But it doesn't come every day, not like you used to. And if you're tempted, we recoil as a hot flame. What do you think calling people on the phone is? It's recoiling. I said, you started recoiling right away. You did everything the book promised that you would do. And you didn't drink. You, instead of going to the first thing first, which is pray with God, you went to everything else. He got to be last, but that's right. You still made it there anyway. You know? Because that's the way most of us are. We don't go to God right away. We want to figure it out. We react sanely and normally. For us, for me to drink is insane. I cannot drink safely. I can drink. Drink when I leave this meeting today. I can drink, but I can't drink safely. I can drink, but I can't drink safely. So it's insane to me to do something that's unsafe that will harm me. Does that make sense? We find this has happened automatically. Oh, how? Through the step work, 4 through 9. Automatically. Something you did. Something's changed in you because if something doesn't change in you and you remain the old you, guess what the old you does? The old you drinks. And eventually you're going to drink. We see this as our new attitude towards liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. I didn't do it. I was willing to let God do it. That applies to my life today. I didn't do it. I allowed God to do it. I didn't set this meeting up. I allowed God to do it. I got around to asking Mike. He said, okay. He could have said no. It just comes. That's the way my life operates. It just comes. We moved the meeting from the Tuesday night at the house. I do the books. I've done it for years. When I started losing a little night blindness, I had finally made up my mind with a little chat with God and a few people that 40 people in that little room was just too many. And so some people quit coming because it was so crowded. And some people wanted to bring people. But my stubbornness about this has got to be where it's got to be because it's convenient for me. And so I said, asked them one night as a group, I said, we need to take a group conference. Do you think we ought to move the meeting? Every hand shot up. I'm the only dummy that doesn't know we need to move the meeting. Next day's Friday, I go to a meeting at 11:30. It's kind of an odd starting time. And after the meeting, one of the girls there and her boyfriend said to me, would you go and have lunch with us at the Chinese restaurant? I said, sure. But I never go have lunch with them people. Not that we're not friends and, you know, we go to meetings together. We're not what I'd call bosom buddies. And we're sitting there and she says, "Oh, how's the book studies going?" I said, "Isn't that funny you would ask?" I said, "We've shut the meeting down in Coma where we've been for 2 years. That, you know, like to spread it around a little bit. And we've moved up, you know, and the house meeting has had to get up, we had to get out of the house. It's just too big." And she says, "I know a place just right for you." I said, "No kidding." She said, "Yep, Pastor Bob." Pastor Bob's got the Christ Lutheran Church up on top of Shell Hill, about 13 minutes from here. I said, "No kidding." And we got up there and met with Pastor Bob and a couple other people. I thought he was going to pay us to take it. I thought he was going to pay us to come in there to his place, you know. "Oh, you don't have to pay us anything. We'll do all that, buddy." I said, "No, okay." And we're getting to do a few other things. And in a way of service for him. But we had 60 people at that meeting last Tuesday night. And they took it. So we started to operate like a real AA meeting in terms of we have a secretary and we have a cleanup crew and we have a set up the chair crew and put down the chair, you know, all that stuff to do. And this little old girl, Jahara is her name, but the name's a little hard to pronounce, so I call her George. And George and I have become big buddies. She likes George. She likes me to call her George. She's going to be a woman boxer. Oh, boy. George is, yeah. So anyway, I said, "George, you're the secretary." So they'd gone off to see Clancy I down in San Jose. She calls me up. She said, "Don." I said, "Yes, ma'am." She said, "I'm now the secretary of the group. Is that right?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "That makes me boss, don't it?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, we took a group conference, and Anthony will come by and pick you up every night." Okay, George. That is the miracle of it. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We've not even swore off. Instead, the problem has been removed. Alcohol is not a problem for me today. I can go anywhere. I'm a free human being. I went from the alcohol as the master of my life to a guy with total freedom. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor afraid. That is our experience. This is how we react so long as we keep in what? So did I tell you a lie? I'm here to get in fit spiritual condition and stay that way. It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We're headed for trouble if we do. For alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. This is a way of life for me. It's something I must do every day. This is not any different than being a Franciscan. It is a way of life here, and we do this every day. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. What a line. You could spend a lot of time thinking about that. The vision of God's will. Do you know right from wrong? Sure you do. Sure you do. I've always known what is right. I just couldn't do it. I didn't have the power to do it. I knew what was right and wrong. How can I best serve thee? That's my question. I might say it a little different in the morning. I say, "What are we going to do today, God?" That's like saying, "How am I going to serve you?" "Thy will not mine be done." Wow. That's pretty hard to put that out of your way. Particularly when some important engagement is to be kept that means money. Or love or whatever. May not be God's will at that moment. And what is not God's will today does not mean it's not God's will tomorrow either. These are the thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It's the proper use of will. He just told me the proper use of my will. To align my will with God's will. Every day. Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from Him who holds all knowledge and power. Isn't it interesting? In the book,
when it was written originally in the, on page 58, where they talk about how it works, it didn't say path, it said follow direction. Big battle over that thing. They wrote it, I don't remember how many times I've forgotten now, 44 maybe. I mean, it was terrible. If I'd been Ruth Hawks, I'd have drank. I can see her now. You gotta type this over, Ruthie. They've made some more changes. Give me a drink, Phil. And he puts direction right back in the book again. Bill's tricky. He wanted direction in the book. They wanted him to take it out. So he took it out for him, but he puts it back in the book now. Follow direction, the direction to the book. From him who has all knowledge and power, here's a condition. If we have carefully followed direction, laying it on us now, we have begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us. Absolutely. Absolutely. You didn't say it's first weekend, I said, she's very busy. I said, I'll be home on Sunday night. To some, a promise, to some extent we have become God conscious. Yes, we have. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense. I have a sixth sense today that I live on. It comes to me in all forms, usually in the middle of the night. Not too early in my sobriety, a few years in. We must go further, and that means more action. He's going to talk about step 11. Shall we go to lunch a little early today and then come back a little early? And pick it up at 11? Would that be all right with everybody?
God,
grant me the strength to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference.
I'll turn the meeting back over to Don Brown and Mike McKissick.
I'm Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. We are at step 11. Start off a little bit in the 12x12 first, which page 96. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only. For knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. It starts off with prayer and meditation are a principal means of conscious contact with God. So what have we been doing now? We got the tools that were coming. We went through the steps. We made a decision. We got the kit of spiritual tools in 4 through 9 and in 10. As Don explained, we're putting those into practice and we need to stay in fit spiritual condition. Otherwise, we get a reprieve. Reprieve means a stay of execution, and I got to do that daily. And how do I do that? That's part of what 11's about. I've got to experience a conscious contact with God, which when we talk about step 5 and step 9 and step 10, I'm starting to experience that sixth sense, and now I want to do it. So I got to see. In the middle of the first paragraph, he says, we often tend to slight serious meditation and prayer as something not really necessary. To be sure, we feel it is something that might help us to meet an occasional emergency. Well, that was my experience. That's why I prayed. I quit praying when I was about 10 years old. It took me 44 years to start praying again. 10 years old, I had an alcoholic father, came from a neurotic family. Nothing was changing. I used to go to church. My mother was a devout, still is, devout Southern Baptist. And, we prayed as kids, went to church, did all that stuff. Nothing happened. I'm living in a catastrophe and, nobody's doing anything about it. So why am I going and praying and doing all this stuff with God? I'm not having any of it. First time I came to AA, which is a story I told earlier, in 1985, I looked up on the wall. I saw God and I said, I'm out of here. I am not like these people. I'm not having any of that. And it wasn't then until I got to treatment. And I was just at the last door on the block. I didn't wake up and say, wow, I got to go to treatment so I can find a spiritual experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was, I got no place else to go. So, what is the history? Where was I going with that? I think where I'm going with that is a lot of times, and what I just read there is that we don't think about prayer and meditation, or we take prayer and meditation, at least I should say from my own experience, and turn it into something I can't do. And I love the Emmett Fox quote that says, trying to pray is praying. You know, and I extend that to be trying to meditate is meditating. So we're going to talk about prayer and meditation, and it's always somebody wants to say, okay, you're going to tell me how to pray and how to meditate, and that's not going to happen. And I don't think Bill does that in the book. You know, what we're going to talk about, that I need a conscious contact with God, and everybody, just as everybody has their own spiritual experience, they have their own conscious contact with God, and they develop the things that they need to do to have a conscious contact with God, and Bill's going to make some suggestions. Now, how did this prayer meditation thing get so ingrained in AA? And I'm going to take a little bit of a history lesson and go back to the Oxford group. Because it was from the Oxford group, as we talked about, Dr. Bob had been a member of the Oxford group for 2.5 years before he met Bill. And Bill basically got sober in the Oxford group, because that's how Ebby came to him, was out of the Oxford group. And I'm talking about that because the Oxford group, one of the things they did was had quiet time. And quiet time was when they had in their meetings, they'd have quiet time, and they would pray and meditate, and they would look for the conscious contact with God. And one of the things they did was they were to listen. And what happened was, is they would actually keep a notebook, and in the archives there's Dr. Smith's wife Annie's book, where at the Oxford group, they actually wrote down, you would be meditating, and if you had a thought, you would write it down in your meditation, and then afterwards they'd come back and they would sit down one-on-one in sort of a sponsored relationship, but with another person that was in the program at the Oxford group, and say, wow, let's look and see which of these are my thoughts, my selfish, self-centered thoughts, and which are, in fact, some kind of guidance or direction from God. Two-way, what they call two-way prayer. And that's sort of the history of prayer and meditation for the Oxford group, and given that both of the founders who were involved in that program sort of evolved into what Bill talks about in prayer and meditation in the book. I say that because what it's going to talk about is listening. And I use my little, no, my phone's not on, ditto. So when I came to AA, this is the only way I knew to pray. I say, oh, well, God, this is my, things aren't going very well. I don't want to go to jail again. My wife is terrible. You got to change her. I need more money and a new Porsche. And if those things all happened, I would be happy. And, you know, get everybody off my back. Thank you very much. Never once did I turn the phone around and say, God, what do you want me to do? What do you want me to be? And then shut my mouth and listen. Because if I'm going to ask for something, I need to listen for it. And that's the essence of the two-way prayer. So one more thing out of the big book, because we're talking about meditation a little bit, but one of the things that I really like on page 99, because Bill was talking about meditation as well, and he says, you know, at the bottom of page 99, he says, beginners in meditation, we might now reread this prayer several times very slowly. You know, it's like everybody says, what's to meditate? What's to pray? You know, and the fact is, there's lots of stuff out there. Bill suggests that if you're starting in the program, that one of the places to start is on page 99, and I want to do meditation, is to sit down with the St. Francis prayer. And that's, Lord, make me a channel of thy peace. Great prayer. Bill's suggestion. I suggest to all my guys that I sponsor that, you know, when you start prayer and meditation, don't go any place. Just start. And a great place to start is with that prayer. Lots of other places to start too, but that's the prayer. So about page 85 in the big book, it says, step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. What does constantly mean? It means all the time. That means that if I'm going to pray and meditate, Bill's telling me that it's going to take practice and it's going to take time. That's what constantly means to me. It works if, conditional word, we have the proper attitude and work at it. So he reiterates what he just said. I'm going to need time, I'm going to need patience, and I'm going to need practice. That is my experience. He said, it'd be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we could make some definite and valuable suggestions. So when I first went to treatment, they said, you're going to start praying. I said, I'm not going to start praying. They said, here's what you're going to do. You know, it's almost universal. You know, you go to bed at night, you say, thank you. And you wake up in the morning, you say, please. That's about all you can get to right now. And that's all I could do. God, thank you. Then it was, thank you for keeping me sober. God, please help keep me sober today. And from there you start. After you get done with that, you sit still for a while. How long do I sit still? Let's see, on day two of treatment, it was about 37 seconds. You know, that was all the meditation I had. As time went on, and as I practiced, and I paid attention, and I practiced the examples that are in this book, that grows. And like everything else in this program, we make progress, not perfection. We grow in understanding. We just said in step 10, we grow in understanding and effectiveness. Our prayer and our spiritual life will grow as we experience those things that happen to us in the program. It's a program of experience. I'm going to learn because I did it. I had the experience, and that's going to support me to do it again. So he has valuable suggestions. So it says, when we retire at night, we would constructively review our day. I'll never forget this. I had a guy in a meeting one time say, but I don't retire at night, I retire in the morning because I work night shift. Oh, it's good. Whenever it is, you're going to bed, that's retiring. And it says, we're resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid. This is going back to that tenth, what we talked about in the tenth step. That goes right back to step four. I'm inventorying again. And anybody that says, you know, you do an inventory one time in this program and that's the only time you do an inventory, you just got to say in step 10 that we're going to continue to take it, continue and continue and continue, and now the suggestion says at night we constructively, you know, review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? That's step 4. Do we owe an apology? That'd be 9. Have we kept something to ourselves which we should have discussed with another person at once? 5. Were we kind and loving towards all? Is love and tolerance our code? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? Or were we thinking about what we could do for others? Of what we could pack into the stream of life? See, I'm just taking an inventory. And one of the handouts that's in your package is that asset and liability checklist. Makes a great daily inventory. I can sit down and I can look at my assets and my liabilities, what percent am I in, what percent am I not in, every night. I can see how my life is changing. I can see how my day is. I can look at that inventory. Does that make sense? But it says, but we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. And I understood that because that would, like, make Mike feel bad. But then he messes that up and says, no, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. You see, I can't get out of self. I am always looking to be out of myself. Selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my trouble. So I'm not going to look at my day and you know, what? How much worry and remorse. I mean, I've turned all that over. That's not part of my life. I'm not the director. I'm not God anymore. So I want to look at it and get through my day, do an honest appraisal. And then, after making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. So I got to